Good morning. We as Unitarian Universalists concern ourselves with many social justice topics and have seen many successes, or at least serious positive attention, with campaigns such as affirmative action, marriage equality, racial profiling, and the Black Lives Matter movement in recent times. But so much remains to be done with those movements, and the best thing to arm oneself with in light of these campaigns and the dozens of other campaigns that individuals within the sanctuary concern themselves with is knowledge. Today, Reverend John Lou Johnstone's sermon is entitled Lessons from a BLGT Culture. Armed with the insights we gain today, we can more easily be an active participant in this movement, or even just an ally, but at least an informed one. So welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Mark Clark, and I'll be convening today. If this seems like a little deja vu, it is. I was here last week as well. I got a phone call from Dick Beeman, and he said, I think you need a little bit more practice to get it right. So I said, I'll tell you what, Dick, if you double my salary, you're on, and he foolishly did, so. And Reverend Johnstone is standing in for somebody, so she scrambled, and I'm sure it'll be great, so. I have a number of announcements. I believe they're all in your order of service. First and foremost, this afternoon from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Beeman home is the farewell to Charlie and June Kempthorne. It doesn't look like they made it here. They were pretty worn out from all of the yard sailing they were doing. And so anyway, they were taking this morning off and resting for the big event. There's a Paths to Membership class that you can read about starting September 20th. And then, of course, the Musicale, the big event, September 13th. Hope everybody will be there. It'll be a great time. Okay, Larry. I'd like to offer these words from Elizabeth Strong as we light the chalice this morning. Reverently, I offer this symbol of our hope and high intent. Reverently, I bequeath this faith to you, this flame to you. This is the light that is lit for everyone who comes into the world. Bear this light to others one by one. Let the flame go from life to life till all is lit with its warmth. Tell that the light means wisdom. Tell that the light means kindness. Tell that the light means understanding. Tell that the light means tolerance. Tell that the light means sacrifice. Tell that the light is a vision of a fairer world. Tell that this is the light that is lit for everyone who comes into this world. Now, if you'll stand as you are able and join us in singing opening hymn 170, We Are a Gentle, Angry People.
Oh, I'd like to invite the children up to join me here. I have a story today that is an animal story, and it's a true story. It's about penguins. Whoops. All right. That's all right. And it happens in the Central Park Zoo. The Central Park Zoo is in the middle of New York City. And if you look and see in these pictures, you see a lot of families going to the zoo to look at what's at the zoo. And one of the things that they find there is families of animals, right? So what animals do we see here? Red panda. Red panda, yeah? And there's some, anything else you recognize? Toads. There are some toads and some monkeys. Do you know these guys? Yeah?
Okay.
Toucans. And do you know these guys? They're cotton top tamarins. Yeah, you might have missed that, but anyway. Okay, and there are penguins. In the penguin house, there are a bunch of penguin families. And every year, at the same time of year, the girl penguins start noticing the boy penguins, and the boy penguins start noticing the girl penguins, and when the right boy and girl penguin find one another, they become a couple. Except there are two penguins in the penguin house who were a little bit different. One was named Roy, and the other was named Silo. And Roy and Silo were both boys, but they did everything together. They bowed to each other, and they walked together, and they sang to each other, and they swam together, and wherever Roy was, there was Silo. They didn't spend much time with the girl penguins, and the girl penguins didn't seem to notice them very much. But Roy and Silo wound their necks around each other, and their keeper, Mr. Gramsay, noticed that the two penguins, and he thought to himself, they must be in love. Roy and Silo watched how the other penguins made a home, so they built a nest of stones for themselves, just like the other penguins, and every night, Roy and Silo slept there together, just like the other penguins did. And every morning, Roy and Silo woke up together, but one day, Roy and Silo saw that the other couples could do something they could not. The mama penguins would lay an egg. She and the papa penguin would take turns keeping the eggs warm until finally it would hatch. And then there would be a baby penguin. And Roy and Silo didn't have an egg. They didn't have an egg to keep warm, and they didn't have a baby chick to feed and cuddle with. Their nest was there, it was nice, but it was empty. So one day, Roy found something that looked like what the other penguins were hatching, and he brought it to their nest. It was only a rock. But Silo sat on it carefully and sat and sat. And when Silo got sleepy, he slept. And when Silo was done sleeping and sitting, he swam and Roy sat. Day after day, Silo and Roy sat on the rock, but nothing happened. Then Mr. Gramsay got an idea. He found an egg. There had been another couple of penguins who had two eggs, and they could only take care of one. So Mr. Gramsay took the extra egg and brought it to Roy and Silo's nest. And Roy and Silo knew just what to do. They moved the egg to the center of their nest, and every day they turned it so that each side stayed warm. And some days Roy sat while Silo went for food, and other days it was Silo's turn to sit and take care of the egg, and they sat in the morning, and they sat at night, and they sat through lunchtime, and swim time, and supper, and they sat at the beginning of the month, and they sat at the end of the month, and they sat every day in between. Until one day, they heard a sound coming from inside their egg. What do you think it was?
Baby.
Beep, 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 beep. And Roy and Silo called back, squawk, squawk. Beep, beep, answered the egg. And suddenly, a tiny hole appeared in the eggshell. And then, crack! Out came their very own baby. She had fuzzy white feathers and a funny black beak, and now Roy and Silo were fathers. "We'll call her Tango," Mr. Gramsci said, "because it takes two to make a tango." Roy and Silo taught Tango how to sing for them when she was hungry, and they fed her food from their beaks. They snuggled her in their nest at night, and Tango was the very first penguin in the zoo to have two daddies. And soon Tango grew strong enough to leave the nest, and Roy and Silo took her to swim, and just like all the other penguin families. And all the children who came to the zoo could see Tango and her two fathers playing in the penguin house with the other penguins. "Hooray, Roy! Hooray, Silo! Welcome, Tango!" they cheered. And at night, the three penguins returned to their nest. There they snuggled together, and like all the other penguins in the penguin house, and like all the other animals in the zoo, and like all the other families in the big city around them, they went to sleep. And that's the story of Tango the penguin. Thank you. And you all can go to your classes.
Go in love.
Our hearts go with you. Go in joy.
And now it's time for our joys and sorrows. This is a time for sharing of significant and sacred mileposts in your life. And I'd like to have you think of this place, this sanctuary, and all the people in it as the top step of a podium from which you can stand with arms raised in victory as you reveal your triumphs to us. Or picture this as a stage. The spotlight is on you as you share significant joys with pride. Or this sacred place can serve as a safe haven in a storm if it's a sorrow you wish to share.
Shirley Hobrock, membership chair. We have a joy that we have a new member, Ellen Meyer. Ellen, would you stand up? And a former member we had before, several years ago, Roger Johnson, has reinstated his membership.
Pleasant surprise that Michaela and Jessica's favorite uncle is visiting, my brother Randy.
Guess that's it. Tiny joy, it's my birthday tomorrow.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah, okay. Good.
for those joys, triumphs, and sorrows that you have shared. Know that we are your podium, your stage, or your safe haven. For all those that have not been shared, please know that we will always be here for you. For today's reading, I'll be reading excerpts from Another Mother Tongue, Gay Words, Gay Worlds by Judy Gron. What gives any group of people distinction and dignity is its culture. This includes a remembrance of the past and a setting of itself in a world context whereby the group can see who is relative to everyone else. I've always been bothered by the definition of homosexuality as a behavior. Scratching is a behavior. Homosexuality is a way of being, one that can completely influence a person's life and shape its meaning and direction. The German phrase for referring to gay people is vom anderen Ufer, I hope I got that right, which means literally from the other side. In Spanish, especially in Mexican, Chicano, and Pachuco dialects, there are several similar phrases, including es de agua, or is of water, in the sense that being from across the water. De la banqueta, from the other sidewalk, or del otro lado, from the other side, and de los otros, of the others, all referring to gayness. Some people perceive themselves and all of existence as having only one side, and I suppose that's sometimes a useful way to maintain a stable society, just as long as those on that one side don't insist that their monochrome perception is the only true one. I believe that gay culture is at its heart continually, however unconsciously, trying to reveal the other side. Sometimes just to reveal the fact that there are sides. I believe we do this with regard to the sexes, to work roles, to the world of judgment and value, of aesthetics, of philosophies, of other realms of consciousness. We act out of irony, essential humor, and paradox. Old Gaia's children stand at the intersections of the universe, pointing out the various directions. And the intersection may be a Dianic crossroad where offerings are left, an Indian four-direction cross painted on the ground, a voodoo or an African crossroad related in a story, or the crossroad may be pointed out as a dream of another world, the possibility of going over the rainbow. So for our second hymn today, stand as you're able and join us in hymn number 95.
There is more love somewhere.
am a fan of the Tony Awards. Not that I've actually been to Broadway more than once, but I do try to stay on top of what's doing well on the Great White Way. Rarely, though, does watching the Tony Awards show make me break down in tears. Maybe a little tear at the corner of my eye when they do that memorial part that's always my favorite, or for a particularly stirring speech, one that I can actually listen to instead of glazing over at the list of thank yous. But this year's Tonys were something else. The winner for Best Musical, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, Best Actor, and Best Direction. Anybody know? Fun Home. It's a musical that's based on, a cartoon memoir, a graphic non-novel. The author calls it a family tragic comic. Alison Bechdel, a lesbian feminist comic strip artist who I've been reading for the last 30 years, wrote Fun Home. In the mid-80s, I reviewed her comic collections, a series called Dykes to Watch Out for the Washington Blade, the gay newspaper, for which I usually reviewed religious and spiritual books. But for some reason, I don't know, maybe I was their only lesbian feminist reviewer, I don't know, but I always got to do the Bechdel books. And I even have a T-shirt with an Alison Bechdel cartoon on it. I cried watching the Tonys because times have changed so much that a tiny niche culture, one that I was intimately involved in, received recognition and awards, genuine awards, from the mainstream. If that's not incredible, I don't know what is. I have to acknowledge that I would not have picked this topic so early in my time here with you. Another speaker was scheduled to address BGLT literature, and that broke down, and I thought, well, I could just keep the topic the same. That's something I can talk about. And it'll help you know me a little bit better and the way that I process theology or meaning, which I believe is what a sermon is meant to do. There are other more pressing matters in the world. The refugee crisis in Europe, the Black Lives Matter movement here in the U.S., the horrors of violence we're witness to daily in the news. And there are more pressing matters in our congregation. How we want to reach out into the larger community to make a difference, how we want to be together as minister and congregation, how we want to be inclusive to a variety of theological and spiritual perspectives while maintaining our commitment to the tradition of skepticism and the value of doubt. There's so much we have to talk about together. And I don't want you to believe that because I'm a lesbian, my focus is exclusively or even primarily around these issues. But oh well, life happens. We are where we are, and our task is to join in where we are. So, back to Bechdel. If you don't follow the Tonys but are plugged into pop feminism, you may have heard of her obliquely through what's called the Bechdel test for movies. Anybody know it? It first appeared in one of her comics. A movie passes the Bechdel test if there are at least two women characters who both have names and have at least one conversation with each other about something other than a man. You would be surprised how many movies, even very fine movies, fail the Bechdel test. But that's an aside. It makes a point, though, about where I enter the conversation on BGLT culture, which is in the feminist movement, more particularly in the lesbian feminist movement. In many ways, we can't speak of the BGLT culture. Rather, it's more appropriate to speak of cultures. That shows up in the various ways BGLT gets abbreviated, LGBT, GBLT, all the same, but different. They each have their own particular orientation. LGBT became popular among lesbians, put lesbians first. And then bisexual and transgender people said, but we're the ones who always get left off. Let's put it in alphabetical order. So, hence BGLT. So, you see them initials in all different kinds of ways. And I think it makes a point about the culture. Bagdell's Fun Home also makes some points about the culture. Though it's a comic, it's a very serious work. It's full of deep literary allusions and words that I had to look up in the dictionary. The Fun Home is a family abbreviation for funeral home, where her father carries on the family business on a part-time basis. Her father, who it turns out, and maybe I should do a spoiler alert here, is himself gay and apparently commits suicide. So for me, that reminds me of that early BGLT culture, or maybe I should just say gay, because that was before all the initials. The books and movies that alluded to the homosexual enterprise in the first half of the 20th century all ended tragically. Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness from 1928 is one of the most prominent. If you don't get it from the title, it really is rather depressing. And though there is nothing approaching a sex scene in it, simply an acknowledgement of feelings, it was widely condemned as obscene. After World War II, a whole underground of pulp lesbian novels, the dime store type, developed with formulaic characters and plots, almost always ending in suicide or madness. In 1952, when Patricia Highsmith brought out The Price of Salt, it was a very different thing. It was a major change because it was the first of these books to end the formula with a happy ending. Now imagine the combination of excitement and self-loathing that is created by skulking through library stacks or dusty bookstore bins or even dictionaries and discovering some acknowledgement that people like you might actually exist, and then finding only nasty endings and shadows of the wages of sin. Talk about mixed feelings. Yet, as people will, people found one another. And really, until the most recent times, they found one another furtively. Whether speaking in coded language, one of the phrases I learned shortly after coming out was, "I think we go to the same church." Friends of Dorothy communicated a shared interest in Judy Garland, Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, or at least a recognition of her as a gay icon. The handkerchief code for placement and color of bandanas indicated certain sexual interest and served as communication for gay male cruising. So at the time, both men and women who lived outside what was considered respectable norms had no choice but to develop their own secret ways of being in the world. And the bar scene was a big part of that. Well into the 20th century, gay life in many places, especially away from the big cities, centered on bars. Not always a conducive place for building long-term healthy relationships, but often leading to what can only be called creative cultural expressions, challenging rigid gender conformity. Drag queens entertained and helped to create camp, a style that challenged conformity and middle-class values with an over-the-top dramatic flair, think RuPaul or even Liberace. Meanwhile, in the 1950s, there were gay and lesbian people who wanted to find one another outside the bar scene. They wanted to be accepted in the larger society, and they wanted to accept themselves. Groups like the Mattachine Society and Daughters of Bilitis formed to provide an alternative to the bar-based society and to address the disdain for homosexuality politically. Dressed in gender-conforming suits and dresses, they picketed federal buildings and pressed the psychiatric community to drop their pathologizing of homosexual behavior. Now, the tension between outrageously embracing our differentness and conforming to prove our normality has characterized BGLT culture and fueled tensions among its different expressions. And maybe that's true for any subculture that finds itself outside the mainstream. Despite the early political efforts that encouraged the route of normalization, the gay rights movement went generally ignored until an uprising from the other side of the line. A routine bar raid in June 1969 in Greenwich Village turned into an explosion of repressed rage. Drag queens, homeless youth, and butch lesbians, finally exhausted by the brutality of police and the exploitation of the mob who ran the bars, rioted for days. And these riots were ones like you have never seen. Besides the regular overturned cars, fires, and uprooted parking meters that were used as weapons, there were chorus lines with catchy lyrics. Don't get me wrong, it was a riot, but it was rough. But as Allen Ginsberg said, the guys there were so beautiful, they've lost that wounded look that fags all had 10 years ago. Meanwhile, the Mattachine Society urged, quote, our people to please help maintain peaceful and quiet conduct on the streets of the village. And when the Mattachine Society held their regular protests later in the year, they could not convince some of the new participants not to hold hands publicly. It scared the straight people. But what was then called gay liberation could not be turned back. And the tensions remain to this day. While in recent years, gay activists have focused on equal marriage, a normalizing goal, one that says we want to be like everyone else, I've heard from the fringes of the movement, especially youth, people of color, and transgender folks, that marriage didn't matter to them so much, that they were more concerned that people like them were dying of homicide and suicide, and that they aren't interested in entering conventional institutions of a society that doesn't even see them as human. We're living in a time of upheaval and mixed messages. While you can't have a TV show about high school anymore without an out gay character, the Trevor Project, a suicide hotline for gay youth, got 44,000 calls last year. 44,000 youth, most of them suicidal, at least deeply, deeply depressed. A lot of pain still exists for people who are bucking societal norms. The gap between media portrayals and real life in the hallways of a high school or an office building, for that matter, can send people swirling into the abyss. The black womanist lesbian poet Audre Lorde wrote, "For those of us who live at the shoreline, standing upon the constant edges of decision, crucial and alone, for those of us who cannot indulge the passing dreams of choice, who love in doorways coming and going in the hours between dawns, looking inward and outward at once before and after, seeking a now that can breed futures like bread in our children's mouths so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours. For those of us who were imprinted with fear like a faint line in the center of our foreheads, learning to be afraid with our mother's milk, for by this weapon, this illusion of some safety to be found, the heavy-footed hoped to silence us. For all of us, this instant and this triumph, we were never meant to survive. And when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. When the sun sets, we are afraid it might not rise in the morning. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may never eat again. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. And when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard.
nor welcomed. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it's better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive. The pain Lord speaks of brings into being the anger that produced Stonewall, and that Holly Near, a feature on the women's music circuit, spoke of in the song we sang earlier. We are a gentle, angry people. And sometimes people don't like that first line. Must we be angry? Really? The song was written in the wake of the assassination of Harvey Milk, one of the earliest elected gay officials in San Francisco, whose murderer, Dan White, famously used the Twinkie defense. That is, his diet of junk food had led him unable to discern right from wrong. Well, Dan White had his own issues and later committed suicide, I believe. But Milk, another of our GBLT icons, knew that he was risking being killed. Prophetically, he said, "If a bullet should enter my brain, let that bullet destroy every closet door." Of course, the response to his death was anger. We are a gentle, angry people. People who are radically different from the norm often feel we were never meant to survive. And we have all kinds of reactions to that. For a while, when I was young, I identified as a lesbian separatist, though never as radical as some of the people I knew. The separatists saw patriarchy as so dominant that it could not be resisted. Instead, we needed to build an entirely new world, a separate culture for women, that spelled W-I-M-M-I-N, would take care of ourselves. We created women's land and women's music festivals and women's newsletters and presses and imagined a world without male oppression. We read Her Land, a utopian novel that Charlotte Perkins Gilman wrote in 1915 about a society of women who reproduced through parthenogenesis. And we flocked to the Michigan Women's, that's W-O-M-Y-N, music festival by the thousands each summer, where for a time we created a woman-only space and we could do anything from sound to security to building the sets to playing the music to pyrotechnics. This year was the last Michigan Women's Music Festival. Controversy was always part of the festival, trying to establish an anti-racist as well as feminist space fully accessible to all women, including the differently abled. So there was always controversy. But eventually, the festival ran into real trouble as queerness and transgender issues emerged. Many young people, particularly, see gay and straight, male and female, as way too binary, too constricting. They speak about fluidity and queerness. And before I go on, I have to acknowledge that the word queer is, perhaps not surprisingly, not viewed monolithically within the GLBT community. I actually started to call this sermon Lessons from Queer Community and decided it was better to avoid that word at the outset. For many older gay and lesbian people, queer is a word full of unredeemable pain. But I can't bring the cultural conversation into the 21st century without considering what the embrace of queerness has meant for the movement. Eva Sedgwick, widely recognized as one of the founders of queer theory in the 1980s, defined the word queer as the open mesh of possibilities, gaps, overlaps, dissonances and resonances, lapses and excesses of meaning, when the constituent element of anyone's gender, of anyone's sexuality, aren't made or can't be made to signify monolithically. Got that? Let me rephrase it. Queer says that we can't define ourselves in one clear, unambiguous gender or sexual orientation, that possibilities exist beyond the stereotypes we seem to have accepted as our appropriate roles and positions in society. Queer is also used as a verb. Queering a work of literature, for example, is to look for subtext in it by considering gender and/or sexual orientation in an unexpected way. For instance, queer theory applied to the Bible became queer theology. And there were David and Jonathan. You probably remember King David, the battler of Goliath, romancer of Bathsheba, and all-round messy hero. Jonathan, son of King Saul, David's predecessor, loved David, and David loved Jonathan. They make a covenant together, and they never allow family or role to come between them. When Jonathan dies, David grieves deeply, saying, and these words are found in 2 Samuel, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Greatly beloved were you to me. Your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women." Now, with a queer eye, the meaning of that changes, as does the perception of the beloved disciple of Jesus. And we wonder that the words of a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried." The words of a daughter-in-law to a mother-in-law became traditional in heterosexual weddings. Of course, in the literary world, we found Proust and Proust, I never can say that, and Gore Vidal, and even James Baldwin with Giovanni's Room, and Virginia Woolf with Orlando, whose characters stepped over the cultural prescribed lines of sexuality and gender. And queer theory took new looks at Walt Whitman and Willa Cather. But we also find in queer theory new analyses of Dickens and other unexpected players. Of course, queer theory has its detractors. Andrew Sullivan, the self-described conservative gay writer, has said that queer theory's, and I quote, "argument is that the whole notion of gender is wrong, there's no such thing as responsibility, and any attempt to go by the rules is oppressive," end quote. But Andrew Sullivan, as a conservative, generally favors the rules even when they are truly oppressive. For me, on the other hand, one of the great gifts of queerness, of non-conforming gender identity and sexual orientation, is that we open the possibility of freedom not just for those of us who are gay or lesbian, but for everyone. Alison Bechdel in Funhouse wrote, "I suppose that a lifetime spent hiding one's erotic truth could have a cumulative renunciatory effect. Sexual shame is in itself a kind of death." Sexuality as a whole has become less shameful as homosexuality has lost its staunch condemnation. Gender nonconformists have led the way in loosening gender-based role and wardrobe restrictions, helping us recognize that work boots can fit women and menswear can sport bows, while women can climb electrical poles and men become nurses. I concede those boundaries remain more rigid for men than for women at this time, but the barriers are falling. Target took down the signs identifying toys as girls and boys. Hallelujah, about time. If queer culture can help us to see the subtext, to recognize who has been left out or who lurks in the shadows, whether the shadows of literature or of society, then it's done us a great favor. It has bent rigid expectations so more of us can be our authentic selves with less fear of repercussions. Make no mistake, the challenge has not been completed. We have more to do to dismantle stereotypes, to protect vulnerable people, and to change both social rules and actual laws to make our world more inclusive and empowering. We have come a long way, though. I invite you at this time to reflect or meditate on what this means for you. Are there gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender people in your life whose culture and identity have influenced you? How does your gender conform and differ from what others expect, from what you expect? How does your comfort or discomfort with nonconformity affect your life? What would it take for you to live a fully authentic life? And if there are some brief comments, I would welcome them now.
I guess I'm nonconformist and not having children. That's a real conversation killer when the question comes to you about, do you have a family? You know, having a spouse does not count.
I think one thing that really affected me as a child that I didn't realize until I was older is that my parents served as a safe home for BGLT children in my small rural community. And when I was a kid, I didn't really understand why these kids I knew in the community would come and spend a few days at our house, but they just did, and we made them welcome, and then my parents would convince their parents to take them back and try to, you know, but we would always have them over for dinner and things like that. And it wasn't until I was older and understood why that happened that it greatly impacted me.
There are so many youth still who are in danger. Youth homelessness is very heavily, homeless youth who are independent are very heavily gay, lesbian, or queer identified. Very heavily. And sometimes it's because their parents have thrown them out. Sometimes it's because they couldn't withstand the strictures of living in their home. And what's really sad is to see them end up congregating at the fringe of gay culture, where they end up prostituting themselves very often, if nothing else, to find a place to sleep at night, being taken advantage of in very horrible ways, and dying at rates that it's hard to even imagine.
In the beginning, when you talked about identifying with different people, I didn't understand the Judy Garland reference.
Ah, well, the Judy Garland reference is just that gay men in particular were very strong followers of Judy Garland. And so this code did develop, Friends of Dorothy, which was in reference to Judy Garland, and it meant gay. And still, I think still sometimes on cruise ships, they'll have Friends of Dorothy meetings, and that's for anybody who's gay identified to go to a Friends of Dorothy. So, and you know, people talk about that icon of Judy Garland being involved with the Stonewall riots too, because she had just died. And so there was pain in the gay community around this icon of theirs, Judy Garland, dying.
I thought it was Julie Newmar that was...
and Bette Midler, and there's more than one icon.
Well, I'm interested in what you said about the. I just kind of realized the. Am I saying this right? The dualistic representation of our sexuality is really destructive, and it locks us into all kinds of behaviors, prescribed behaviors. Recently, my three daughters were home. They spoke really frankly about their relationships with their partners, and I wouldn't say I was shocked. I was almost as shocked, but that they were so frank and expressed like things about, you know, like, how they slept together and just all kinds of things, how they talked about their partners and their relationships was so unlike anything like my mother would have thought or even me that I even considered. So that's really interesting. Sorry, choking on my old slobber. Thank you. That's really interesting.
Diane Barker. When I was in graduate school, one of my really good friends who was gay moved to Kansas City, and I'd party with a lot of artists, the big gay scene over there. And there were some people that I really liked, and when I would be having a conversation and you'd reach a certain level of honesty or intimacy, sometimes, whoosh, this garage door would slam. And so I went to my really good friend that, you know, we were just friends. Mm-hmm. No barriers between us. And I said, well, how come every time Greg and I are having like this really good time and I feel like he's my really true good friend, wham, this garage door shuts? And she said, that's the way a lot of people have to protect themselves and don't take it personally. And that, you know, just opened a whole visceral level of understanding. I kind of knew that, but she told me that in words, and it was a great gift.
Well, I join so much of our country in being astonished at how quickly gay marriage, same-sex marriage, has become a fact of life has been accepted in places I would never have thought it would occur. So that's a big milestone. Mm-hmm. But there's still lots to do in the area of discrimination in the workplace and in housing for people of this multi-lettered community. Mm-hmm. Any hopes that things might improve? Improve.
We're clearly headed in a direction. We're clearly headed in a positive direction. But the issue that you talk about now is people are talking about that dilemma of get married on Saturday and fired on Monday. That there are no protections if you do get married. I know a couple of lesbians who want to get married, but they want to go away from their home because they don't want their names published as married because they're afraid of the repercussions. And it's realistic to be afraid of the repercussions still because there are no real protections in much of the country. So those are battles that remain to be fought. Certainly, I think especially job discrimination stuff, housing discrimination, you know, general public accommodations, and part of it is that I think that some of the conservatives see this happening around them and feel a need to kind of assert themselves so that this backlash happens that is challenging. So I think some of those issues, and then of course going to the issues of youth, of suicide, and with transgender people in particular, of homicide. That's just a startling rate. And so, as usual, the people who are more fringe have more of the issues and problems. So I think it's very important that we not say, okay, we've got equal marriage, we're done, because we're not done. But we do need to celebrate the equal marriage. I'm not saying that's not a celebration, but we're not done.
In regard to some of these further issues that we need to deal with, like housing and mm-hmm. job discrimination, do you have examples of places that have made laws, passed statutes and so forth that do embody the kind of protections we're looking for?
Because we
need to do things like that, but we probably would do well to have examples.
Many of the large cities have anti-discrimination ordinances in place. Probably. I mean, you know, that's a piece, but I really think that shifting the cultural understandings is important too, you know, because no matter what the laws are, people can find ways to discriminate if you don't also try to change hearts. But I think changing the laws is important too. Yeah. Yeah.
What was the year of the Stonewall riot?
1969.
I grew up in New York City, but I was not there at that time.
Uh-huh.
So it was, you know, way distant and in the background.
Yeah, yeah, 1969.
Well, I was lucky enough to have been in San Francisco in June. I was in San Francisco for a conference, and I happened to be there on the day that the Supreme Court passed the decision on marriage equality, which was also San Francisco Pride Weekend. And, oh my gosh, it was just overwhelming, the feeling in the city and how joyous it was. And so while I was there, I was thinking back to when I was young. I was a young teenager, and my uncle came to visit us with his roommate. And even as a young teenager, like, you know, back in the 1980s when nobody was openly gay, I knew that adult men didn't come visit their family with their roommate. So I was like, okay. And I was thinking then, and my uncle since has died, but I was thinking then, you know, that weekend, wouldn't it have been fabulous had my uncle been able to come visit our family with his partner or his husband? And it made me really sad. But anyway, I had a conversation with my daughter recently where she was talking about how she just, like, does not get it, why anybody cares if two men want to get married or if two women want to get married. Like, why is that a problem? So I think maybe that's the hope.
Mm-hmm. So growing up, my sister and I, we thought my dad had this mysterious second life. And we used to, maybe when we were teenagers, we used to talk about what's going on? And we would imagine, maybe dad's in the mafia, or maybe dad has another family or something, but we just could sense that there was something he wasn't telling us. And so in my mid-20s, he and my mom either were divorcing or were recently divorced, I can't remember. And we went to visit my dad in Florida because he had moved away from Michigan. And he kept talking about this bar where he was doing work. He was doing electrical work and DJing and things. And he said, I want to take you there. It was a gay bar. And that was his way of telling us, this is who, and he never talked about it. He still doesn't talk about it. It's just, this is who he is. And so that was his way of coming out. And it was amazing how comfortable he looked. Mm-hmm. And if you know my dad, you wouldn't expect that he's Republican and he wears flannel. I don't know, but you can't stereotype. But anyway, I was so surprised, but I was like, oh my gosh, this is what his other life was. And so it was, that's my story.
Hi, my name is Ruth Friedman. I think the whole political system is changing with the young. I think the young people do not have the racial prejudice. They are simply changing our whole way of looking at the world.
They certainly have a different perspective on it than some of us who are older. Let's take one more comment here.
Before I retired, before I retired, I worked at K-State in the international programs, and the countries that we dealt with tended to be the developing countries, mm-hmm. the underdeveloped countries. So we dealt more with Eastern Europe than Western Europe. And one memory that lingers is that whenever the gay issue was raised, I was confronted with a very hostile response in terms of gays ought to be repressed, maybe even put in jail, and not tolerated. And I remember the comment of the president of Iran about 5 years ago when he said that in Iran there are no homosexuals.
Yeah, I think worldwide there are some issues, particularly in some of the developing world. The churches that are struggling the most with this question are the ones that are worldwide churches and that are struggling particularly around Africa, where there are very strong anti-gay attitudes. But one of the bright lights there actually is some of our Unitarian congregations that are in Africa that are fighting for gay rights in very repressive systems sometimes. So there are points of light. So as Unitarian Universalists, we honor everyone, affirming their sexual orientation, gender identity, or the flow among their identities. So may we find ways to embrace and affirm all that is male and female, androgynous, masculine, feminine, gender neutral, butch, femme, queer, and fluid within ourselves and in those we love. And may we find increasing acceptance. May our ways of being in the world lead us to authenticity, to wholeness, and to love. So may it be. Amen. Our closing hymn is in the turquoise book. It's number 1014, Standing on the Side of Love.
There are copies of Teal hymnal.
Teal.
Thank you.
And now may the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us now and always. Amen. That's great.